Spoken word.
A taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene.
Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance. Good morning and welcome to the 3CR Spoken Word Program. My name is Di Cousins and today I'm talking to Janana Vucic about her new book, After War. Welcome, Janana.
Hi, Di. It's nice to be here.
Thank you for coming. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. And this is a trigger warning. The following program includes discussions of some of the terrible things that happen in war. So if that's difficult, come back in half an hour. So Janana, tell me, how did you come to write poetry? Where was your first inspiration? What were you reading at the time?
I honestly can't really remember what I was reading at the time, but I had just started, or I had just changed track in my life entirely. I was intending to be a lawyer, and that wasn't going to happen. It became very clear and apparent to me. And I, at the time, was working for a barrister who was himself working on a book, and I was editing that book, and it allowed me to see that there was a possibility for another kind of career for me. And then I pivoted and started pursuing editing and writing. And at the time, I really thought I was going to be a fiction writer because I read a lot of fiction. And I hadn't, honestly, I didn't really have much interest in poetry before that. And it wasn't until sort of picking up, I think it was actually E. E. Cummings, which is perhaps a little bit embarrassing, but I was in my early 20s. And that really, it sparked something in me. It was really exciting. It was really fresh. I didn't know words could do that. And then I quickly fell down the rabbit hole of poetry.
Wonderful. And were there other writers that you were interested in when you first started reading that were inspiring, maybe different genre or writers you've discovered since then that you find inspiring?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've always been a reader. Ever since I was a kid, my dad, he used to take us to the library and I'd get out the maximum number of books and then just plow my way through them. And I can't really remember the authors that struck me when I was a child, although I do remember really liking Tamora Pierce. But as I got older, who was I interested in? I think I had a bit of a sense that I needed to read all the greats. So there was a lot of Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Kafka. And eventually I realized actually there's a lot of really good modern stuff being written. So I was reading Zadie Smith. I was reading Alexander Hemon, who's a Bosnian writer himself. Just a lot, yeah, more contemporary work started entering my consciousness. And that was very exciting.
Yeah, wonderful. So you were born in Bosnia, yes. Maybe a bit before the war?
Yes, just a year before it started.
Yeah. And then how old were you when you came out?
We were five by the time I was five by the time we arrived, but we left Bosnia sort of the year the war was ending, and I was four and a half when we did.
Right. And do you have many memories of the war?
Yes, but they're very confusing in the sense that there's just sort of moments that I remember that don't cohere into a narrative. For example, I remember playing with a ball in the courtyard of my cousin's apartment building, and the shelling started. And I remember this woman grabbing me and my sister, and she ran with us up the stairs. And I remember sitting on the kitchen floor in her apartment, and we were eating like this, the inside of banana peels.
Oh, okay. Yep.
And so it must have been early in the war, because I can't really imagine that bananas were common thereafter. But also we must have been hungry enough to be kind of running our teeth along the inside of the banana peel. And I also really vividly remember my mother's face because she came sort of pounding on the door. She had been looking for us frantically in the building and she hadn't known where we were. And so I remember her face and just like how red and teary it was and how angry and scared she was. So that's something I remember, but I can't quite place it in a chronology except sort of by intellectualizing, well, it must have been there because there was bananas.
Yeah. So when did you decide or discover that you actually had a lot to say in the, through poetry rather than fiction?
Because I made a very rash decision in my mid-20s. I decided to move back to Bosnia and meet my biological family. So when we left, it was my mother, my sister and myself. And then we met my dad, who has raised me and is he's not my biological father, but he might as well be. But I did have a curiosity about my biological father and my family, and we hadn't spent any time with them growing up, so I decided to move back to Bosnia to a village of 20 people or something. I couldn't speak the language. I was really, really in over my head. And while I was there, I was just sort of confronted with the past, and I had an idea that I would write a memoir about it. And I kept trying to, but it just wasn't cohering into a memoir. There was just too much, there was too many voices, there was too many stories. None of them sort of made sense together. And I began to, or I sort of poetry just started happening instead.
Wonderful, yeah. Well, let's start with a poem. Mm-hmm. So what would you like to read first?
Perhaps Kvrgusha in the New Millennium. Kvrgusha in the New Millennium. We called it Bosnian pizza since we couldn't say its name. One of the many things we couldn't get our mouths around. Kvrgusha, ljuljačka, cvijeće, četvrtak. But also, squat, Antarctica, squirrel, sixth, millennium. It was turning then, and my sister and I sat in the car practicing its bends before the new year caught us by surprise. Mil-en-i-um. Mil-en-i-um. Mille Neum. Millennium. Tongues slippery over syllables, slipping. Our mother out there, quickly popping in. Those days you cracked a window, left the kids in the car. Our windows stayed tight. When it got hot, we fought over them, my sister afraid of what might reach in, me afraid of what could not get out. Those days we were afraid of men, lived in a low-slung bungalow with saloon doors and bodies lurking unseen in the yard. Once, my sister chased me around the house with a knife she kept under her pillow. The knife was for the men, but it had other uses. Once, my sister forgot to return it in the morning and our mother barreled through the house in search, turned everything upside down until she found it gleaming in my sister's bed. We had two knives, a little one and a bigger one. My sister took the big one, the one our mother used to break through chicken bone and slide through flesh, carving the cheap cuts before nestling each piece into a wide pan of dough. The one she washed, then used to cut the Bosnian pizza into thick wedges, which we ate without plates, from the tepsia, a word we knew how to say. Straight from the oven was when it was best, steaming, cream soaking into spongy pores. We ate with a fork in our hands on the floor, cross-legged in front of the heater, our mother seated furthest away. On one side, our arms burned with the grill's red heat. On the other, our skin prickled against the cold. In the car, a man stopped to look at us, leaned his back against the wall, hooked his thumb into his belt, grinned. My sister was always seeing men outside her window. The bad man, the bad men. In the car, her scream was an avalanche, and it buried us until our mother came to dig us out. By then, the man was gone. The man was always going. On the way home, my sister said, "Millennium." And I said, "You're saying it wrong." And my mother said, "Osavia na miru." When I refused to eat meat, our mother offered me the choicest pieces, digging them out of the Bosnian pizza with her knife, gouging a hole. When I refused to eat meat, our mother frowned and gestured, said, "It's not meat, it's chicken," gritted her teeth and said, "Eat." Gritted her teeth and said, "Please." This is how we learn to love. Gouging flesh, gripping knives, calling things by other names.
Beautiful. Yeah, it must have been a very tricky upbringing between cultures, and I mean, even the normality of sitting on the floor and eating, and is compared to sitting at tables and chairs. Mm. And so there was, did you feel that adjustment, or were you too young to really notice how many things there were that you had to change or were asked to change?
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't actually thought about that for a long time. I certainly remember feeling very strange in school, and we didn't, or at least I didn't have a lot of friends. I can't speak for my sister for a long time. We part of that was also that we moved around a lot, but part of it is also that I think we just weren't used to, I mean, we couldn't speak English for one, but there was just a lot of sort of cultural norms that we hadn't yet developed and hadn't come in line with the Australian way. But honestly, I think we were so surrounded in those early days by other people who had also come from other places. So we didn't feel specifically unusual until we sort of worked our way up the sort of class ladder a little bit, and then were surrounded by predominantly white Anglo-Saxon Australians, and then things seemed stranger. But by that point, we were also, I think, quite good at, I guess, sort of hiding our Bosnianness. Which is certainly something that I did for a long time.
Yeah. So it must be quite a relief to actually start to process the experience through the poetry.
Yeah, it really is. I have to say my mother was quite surprised by it, because I think she got really used to us not processing it, or sort of having sort of buried and sublimated it. And I remember very early on in my writing career, she had seen a bio of mine and said, "Bosnian Australian. Since when are you Bosnian?"
Well, what did you say?
I think I've always been Bosnian. It's just, you know, it kind of gets lost in the wash, because at that time I was going by like these very westernized nicknames, and no one was calling me Janana, but I was still Bosnian.
Yeah. And it must have been interesting to also see how much you'd been changed by Australia, the Australian experience, when you went to live back in Bosnia.
Yeah, definitely. it was a daunting thing to do, partly also because I was very worried that my family would judge me, because I have tattoos, I have piercings, I have short hair. I'm not a very typical representation of like Bosnian femininity. So I was quite concerned that they would find me, I don't know, frightening or disconcerting in some way. And probably they do to some extent, but they always say, you know, you were raised in a different culture, so of course you're different. And that's very comforting. But it is also true that I'm just very, very different. And in the ways that I didn't feel like I fit into so-called Australia, it's also very, very clear to me that I'm also not just Bosnian.
Yeah, well, I think we're all a blend of our history and ancestry and experience and life and, you know, the context in which we find ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I'd like to go to the poem Trigger Warning.
Mm-hmm. Trigger Warning. And what I'm saying is sometimes you don't get a trigger warning before someone pulls the trigger. Before your body in the wet heat pressed by bodies hunting insides. There are 60,000 women in my country at least, and I want more for them than our painful avoidance. Yes, I want you to cry. I want you to feel the things you don't want to feel, which are anyway only a shadow of the things they did not want to. I know I'm being polemic. I know I'm being unfair. I know that you don't deserve this, but neither did they. There is so much unraveling we are permitted to turn from. And I've lost interest in your feel-good Netflix binge, your escape from the escape that is your comfortable middle-class life. No one deserves this, but some people must bear it. And I want revenge for the 60,000 women who did. The 60,000 women who didn't get a trigger warning. And what good would it have done them anyway? You don't get to opt out of genocide or rape. Not if you're the victim. And sometimes not if you're the man with the gun. Trigger warning. Rape. Trigger warning. Torture. Trigger warning. War. Trigger warning, genocide. I'm not usually like this, but yesterday a friend said, "This is too much for me." And we have been friends for so long, and her past has never been too much, but mine, my people's, is an unbearable weight. Another time, friends could not watch a documentary about refugees and had to leave the room, and me there, the only refugee in the room, knowing the value of not looking away, of swallowing hurt that is not yours because it should not be theirs either, and if this is the least we can do, we must do it. Because 60,000 women could have been saved and 100,000 people could still be alive if only we hadn't been watching Law and Order, if only we hadn't left the room. I said, look at me when I'm talking to you. You won't believe the things I remember, the things I have seen and heard, the things that live rent-free in my body and make my flesh a roiling parody of survivor's guilt. I have so much pain to milk, don't even get me started. But I'm not trying to force you to drink it. I just want you to know where it's from, and how dare you deny us that? I said, look at us when we're talking to you.
Yes, there's a. It's sometimes hard for those who haven't experienced very hard experiences to even look at, witness the pain that people are going through, who are going through war. And but then it's just kind of a trivializing of experience not to look, I think.
Yeah, I think it can be profoundly dehumanizing for the people on the other side of the screen. And of course, they don't get the option of looking away. They're surrounded by it. This poem was written when I was much younger, and I think I was really angry at our capacity to look away from other people's pain. And as I've gotten a bit older, and perhaps also as the possibility or the inescapability of other people's pain has become inescapable, I do understand a little bit better how people might need to take a moment away from themselves, away for themselves. But I still think we owe it to one another to see and to look at what's happening, because if we don't see it, we can't do anything to stop it.
I remember the time of the Bosnian War very well, and everybody knew there were these rape camps, and they were running for a very long time. And nobody stopped them, and I didn't know who could stop them. I mean, you know, the UN peacekeepers were non-combatants, and when I don't know how many thousands of boys were led away in Sarajevo, they just stood back and watched them be taken. You don't know what kind of intervention is possible when these awful things happen. What are your thoughts in terms of how do people stop it? I mean, that's the problem, you know, living in sunny Australia. We do feel distant and, in a way, helpless.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any solutions. I think it really strikes me that very shortly after Srebrenica happened, and it was 8,000, over 8,000 men and boys were murdered, the war ended very soon after that. America got involved, and I'm not saying that violence is the answer, but political will was the answer. And I think that that is something that obviously we can only do so much as citizens. And I think the last 3 years have shown that even coming out every single week, even all the letter writing, all the sort of conscious raising that is happening isn't necessarily going to change political wills. But I think we have to keep trying. We have to keep pushing. And I don't know. I wish I had a neat or easy answer to it. And I have to admit that sometimes I feel very pessimistic about it. But I guess it's that Gramsci quote. What is it? Pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the will. And I feel like if we just keep pushing, if we keep demanding action, surely something will happen. Surely the political will eventuate.
Yeah, well, in the end, you know, change happens. There is a saying, the arc of history tends towards justice. We only hope that's true. But I'm glad that, you know, we are remembering what happened through your work. You know, even if people did look away, at least we can't look away when we read your poem. So I'm talking to Jenana Vucic about her new book, After War, which is published by the University of Queensland Press. So, Jenana, tell me, how did you actually get the book together? Because it's a wonderful debut collection of poetry, but it's more than 100 pages. So what was your writing process? How did you find all these poems and put them together?
So many of them I wrote while I was in Bosnia visiting family, and I just kept having these sort of moments of inspiration or just had to suddenly write something. But it didn't really cohere into what this collection is for quite a while. It was much, it used to have a different name. It was much, much more rambly or sort of more ranging. And then as I was looking at the poems, I realized that there was a through line that felt really important, and that sort of went, I think, kind of chronologically, but I think also from in to out. And then I was really fortunate to receive a Red Room Varuna Fellowship for poetry. And last year I went there and I was working with my amazing editor, Felicity, and we printed everything out. And then we just laid it on the table and started moving things around. And as that happened, I could sort of see these natural links forming, or this sort of very clear, or it felt clear to me, through line emerging even more than I had suspected before. So that's kind of how that happened.
Yeah. Great. Well, let's read Fainting Goat.
Fainting Goat. My new housemate asks, "Do you scare easy?" Tells me I jump whenever I walk into a room and find someone else already there, in the hall especially, in the kitchen. Once in the living room, I saddle back so quick I fall, socked feet scudding across the floorboards, cartoon-like, legs slipping out from under me, ass hitting the floor, laughter. This is not the first time I have fallen in fright. He asks if there's anything he can do, which is a question I'm used to fielding. Being a person prone to public displays of terror, an internal combustion of the semi-private variety, I'm not good at holding things in. I'm all overflow and overwhelmed. What I want to tell him is yes, change history. Please, change history. What I want to tell him is my body has learned to hold its fear, to cradle it, wound so tight it bursts out along the seams of things. A movement from one room to another, the crack between sleep and wake, a face between expressions, and especially any second of misrecognition. The first time I hear a car backfire, I throw myself to the ground, arms overhead, as though arms might make a difference. They will not. They have not. At New Year's, I'm taught like a last thread, watching explosions in the black sky, shop-bought firecrackers careening down the street like shells. I wait for impact. Really, I'd prefer to stay indoors, window shut tight, to the moment revelry curdles to panic. Don't get me started on a raised hand, immediate recoil into my small self, my vulnerable body. The stories I could tell you about hands, how easily they become fists, how easily they grasp weapons, how easily objects are made weapon. What I say instead is no, I'm sorry, ignore me. I am the fainting goat of humans. What I mean is, if the worst is coming, I prefer not to know. Walk home at night with headphones on, music blaring. If I am to be attacked, I want to be surprised. I want it to be unexpected. I do not want to run and run and still be caught. I have run and am still caught.
Yeah, there's a lot of refugees suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yep.
Does that sound familiar?
Yes, very. How did you know? We are on intimate terms.
Yeah, very hard, very hard. But hopefully there's some healing in the writing, I'm hoping anyway.
Yes, I think it was a really profoundly healing process, actually. And I hope it is also for maybe for other people who have gone through something similar.
Yes, but the car backfires and, another trigger warning. So you did a PhD at Oxford University, at Glasgow University.
Indeed.
In Scotland.
Yes.
And what was that about?
I was looking at auto theory, which is a type of writing that takes the sort of theoretical and puts it through the sort of ringer of the personal. So it's people writing about theory but using themselves as an example. So, for example, Gloria Anzaldúa was a proponent. Also Paul B. Preciado, who took black market testosterone and then wrote about sex and gender through the experience and sort of was speaking back to Foucault and all these people.
Who was the first one?
Gloria Anzaldúa.
What did she do?
A Chicana writer and poet, and she was also sort of a disability activist. But she wrote this book called Borderlands, which was about, essentially like border identity. and she came up with this concept called Autoteoria Historia, which was essentially a theorizing and historicizing through the self. And her example, or herself, was a borderland identity. So she had this concept of the Chicana as a figure or as a form of subjectivity.
Okay. Well,
sorry, that got a little bit theoretical.
Yes. Okay. Well, now there's another poem I'd like you to read called Because the Wind Blazes.
Because the wind blazes through the soft hands of autumn, I let the hurricane burn against my heart. What else are we to do with all this anger? The world will end and we will let it. Every day a kiss is stolen by one stranger from another. Every day a building comes down on a child. They call this being unalived. This is the world that we are making. Not everyone gets to smell time on their fingers or to cook a simple dish for the one who holds their heart. Not everyone gets a life in roses, nor even in crumbs. Yesterday I saw wild horses graze a hillside in the fog. They could not look at me, nor me at them, for shame. Men tell me that some of us are worth avenging, some of us are human, animals. This is a logic I've heard before, having once stood in a zoo and been fed to lions. The world grows small in rain, but does not stay that way. Because after autumn there are other autumns, we learn to eat the wind. This is what we shall do with all our anger. Eat the wind and spit it out. Sometimes the waves will rise so high in our mouths they'll flood out and drown wind farms and off the coasts of rich and modern countries. Sometimes we'll open our chests and, teeth first, throw ourselves from great heights. Do not mistake us. This is the world and we will take it. This is the longest moment ever. And this one. And this.
Beautiful. And that ends this amazing book, After War, by Janana Vucic. So, Janana, you're in Melbourne at the moment, but normally you live in Berlin.
I do, that's true. Somewhat unwillingly, but I'm looking forward to being back home one of these days.
Great. So that's a long-term plan.
Yes. Yeah.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a real pleasure.
Oh, good. So my name is Di Cousins, and this has been the 3CR Spoken Word Program.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
The 3CR Radiothon kicks off in June. To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 94 19 8377,
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.